The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Alongside that, you get a £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Women with Balls, where I, Katie Balls, speak to today's trailblazers. My guest today was born in Glasgow and grew up in East Kilbride. First elected to Parliament as an SNP MP, she has served her home constituency since 2015. After three elections under the SNP, she defected to the Scottish Conservatives in 2023, announcing also plans to step down at the next election. Before Parliament, she worked as a variety of roles within the NHS and was also a trade union representative, and she is the first clinical psychologist elected to the House of Commons. When she switched her allegiance to the Tories, Humza Yousaf, the then First Minister, suggested that it was the least surprising news he had had since becoming First Minister. My guest today is Dr. Lisa Cameron. Lisa, thank you very much for coming on the podcast today. We usually start with what I've been told sometimes is a loaded question, but was yours a happy childhood?
Yeah, generally. I mean, we moved from Glasgow to East Kilbride, which is in my constituency, when I was a baby. And so we moved from a tenement house to, you know, somewhere that had parks nearby, good opportunities in terms of schooling, and a really thriving town centre at that point in time. And so it was generally, yeah, very happy and felt loved. And we had a lot of input from my grandmother as well, who was a huge matriarch of the family and always instilled education as being the way to progress in life. And therefore, I studied a lot as a child and, yeah, felt, you know, very supported at home in that regard.
And at home, was politics or current affairs much of a factor?
I can't say it was. And that's something that I think, you know, politics, I'm not a career politician in that sense. I came from working in the NHS for 20 plus years. So it was more about studying, getting a steady job, I would have said. And I wouldn't say being a politician is a steady job as such. So being a doctor, a lawyer, that was also kind of encouragement at that time. And and I went on to study psychology. But it's interesting because my own daughter has mentioned, you know, how do you become an MP, etc. And I think when I was at school, if they'd said, what do you want to do? And I said, I'd like to be the MP for the town. That would have been something that wouldn't have been thought possible. Whereas my own daughter now thinks that is the art of the possible. So I think we've cracked some glass ceilings there, yeah.
Was religion much part of your life growing up?
And it was. I mean, I went to Sunday school and, you know, something that most children did at that point in Scotland, I think. And went to church on a Sunday. I wouldn't have said it was a massive feature in my life at that time as a young child, but I was just very aware that, you know, we came from a family that did attend church, and there was a kind of camaraderie there as well, as much as you know, a religious belief. So it was kind of a social camaraderie as well, and feeling a community engagement, I think. And I think church groups during the COVID pandemic really came into the fore again, and lots of religious groups actually, to help the most vulnerable at that point in time. And, you know, I think we saw a sort of resurgence of that in terms of local communities coming together and church groups being at the core of that once again.
Now, you already mentioned that you went on to study psychology, but I first wondered, you know, say you wouldn't say MP if the school had asked you what you wanted you to do. What was it that drew you to psychology?
Well, just fascination by behaviour, I suppose, and why people behave in the way they do, personality development, nature, nurture, all of those issues. And I think actually politics is much about psychology too, because when you come to Westminster, yeah, there's the structure of how things are done, but underneath that very much is all the human relations and the different types of personalities coming to the fore. And I just think psychology is very fascinating. And of course, I went on to study and to work in forensic psychology in secure prisons. And so it was about human behaviour as well, departing from the norms and how we rehabilitate people. So that was something that had always been, I think, a challenge in my mind and something that I really thrived on learning and formulating from psychological theories as to why people do the things they do and how to try to change their behaviour.
And when you finished university, I mean, you went on to become a clinical psychologist. And as you said, you're working in the NHS. You looked a lot at addiction and mental health services. Can you just talk us through a bit of your experiences there?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I came out to from university having achieved my doctorate. My family were delighted. I was the first person, you know, in my family to go to university. Went on to work in the NHS and really enjoyed it and worked in addictions for a long time. And that was kind of my first passion. And that led me into forensic psychology as well, working in courts and prisons. And addiction is a huge part of the population that you tend to see, you know, in the court processes. And behind a lot of people's addictions and mental health issues is trauma and childhood trauma, as you had mentioned. And it's very important, and attachment and feeling secure in your attachment and feeling good enough and that you can achieve and that you're a worthwhile person. And, you know, so a lot of the work I did was very trauma focused with people who had addiction issues. And I think that's why some of the policy making, drug consumption rooms, etc. I think that if that's where we're at in terms of policy making, unless we have rehabilitation and people's options to, you know, to enter rehabilitation has been a core feature of that, we're really failing people, because we need to help people to aspire to turn their lives around and to address the core psychological issues that drive them towards addictions and that also underpin mental health issues. And I think we need to really invest in mental health and people and make sure that we have a holistic approach rather than a kind of a rudimentary approach, thinking about harm reduction and those issues. And in Scotland, you know, drug deaths is a huge issue. And I think the government there should really be doing so much more to invest in people's lives and rehabilitation services.
Now, you mentioned earlier you are not a career politician. You obviously had this career within the NHS and you entered Parliament as an SNP politician. I'm going to go in more to where you are now and what took you there later on. But I suppose, at what point did you start to feel party political? Was the independence referendum about the time that you paid more attention to politics in Scotland, or was it something else?
I mean, I think I had engaged a bit in politics because I was a union representative when I was in the NHS for a long period of time. And, you know, employee relations was something that I focused on for part of my week there. I was a Unite representative at the time. I used to be on the Scottish Terms and Conditions Group, which worked with management and government in Scotland to look at staff terms and conditions and negotiate those. So using psychology and negotiation and those types of aspects as well was something that I enjoyed doing. So that was my kind of first engagement with government, as I suppose. And then in the referendum, when you're in the NHS, you don't really focus on politics, to be honest. It's not something you bring into your day-to-day work because, you know, you work with people from all different backgrounds and you just don't bring these issues in. But during the referendum, people from all different professions started to think about constitutional issues because it was such a massive decision at that point in time for the country. And I got involved in some local groups who were working towards trying to create a sort of well-being focused Scotland and looking at how to support NHS structures if an independent Scotland was the outcome of the referendum. And that's what, you know, started my interest. And yeah, I had never expected to become an MP. I'm the first clinical psychologist to be elected to the Parliament. So obviously my constituents maybe thought Westminster needed a psychologist. But, you know, to be straight up about that, it wasn't a plan, but I often think, and that sort of takes me back to, I suppose, you know, having a belief and a faith that, that things that are meant to happen do happen, and that it was sort of meant to be part of my life to be in politics, and that things came together to shape that a bit later in my career. And hopefully that I've been able to bring a lot of experience from health and my work in disability and addictions, as you say, and the court processes, etc., into the work I've done in Parliament too.
And did your parliamentary colleagues welcome having the first psychologist MP?
I think people...
Any comfort advice?
Yeah, there's a bit of trepidation. I think people thought that I'd be analysing everybody.
Why?
Well, you can't help but do that to some degree. But, you know, often in Parliament, you don't have much time because you're juggling so many different issues at the one point in time. I did want to think more about a compassionate politics and how we support people's mental health in politics, because I think it can be a very stressful role. And therefore, you know, I set up the Psychology All Party Parliamentary Group, you know, many years ago, and started to work with the British Psychological Society in looking at some of those issues, and also trying to look at, you know, what more we could do for the welfare of staff and colleagues in Parliament as well. And I was on the Speakers Diversity and Inclusion Group looking at some of those issues for a number of years up until around about 2019. Yeah.
And how did you find it yourself in terms of mental health, stress of that job? Because as you say, lots of people in Westminster do find it very stressful, and you've got a constituency in Scotland, a constituency that you lived in before you represented it. Was it quite an adjustment?
It was a massive adjustment coming into politics for me. The bit that I found the most straightforward was holding constituency surgeries, because I was so used to, you know, as a psychologist, being quite solution focused, helping people to identify their problems and how to address those issues. So that part, you know, I felt that I could cope with quite well. And colleagues would say to me that that was the most difficult part of the role for them, because they weren't quite sure how to help people who came perhaps with different types of issues, mental health issues, to their local surgeries. So there's probably more work can be done to support MPs in those types of issues. The bit that I found most difficult, I suppose, was just learning how Parliament works. You know, when I came down to Westminster after I'd been elected, it was the first time I'd ever been in the House of Commons. So all the way there, I kept thinking, will they let me in, even although I had been elected? because it was just not something from my background, going to the local school, and that you would ever have imagined that you would be in that role. So learning all the kind of how legislation works, how to raise a question, you know, having to think about that you don't raise a question or refer to another member by their name, but you refer to them by their constituency, all these types of issues. I had to kind of factor into my learning, and it seemed, quite... some of the rules were quite kind of strange and took a lot of getting used to. But actually, it's funny how quickly we all become quite institutionalized here. And then all of a sudden, it all seems very normal after a while too. So I think those were the things that I needed to learn. And you know, I had hoped when I originally came in that I'd work on health. And I went to a meeting and said I'd quite like to work on health. And then they announced who was going where, and I was in the foreign affairs team. And I thought, oh, you know, I've not really travelled very much, been to Spain and Greece and Florida, but what do I know about foreign affairs at that point? So you don't always find yourself doing the things that you think you're best suited to, but in a way Parliament stretches you in all different directions, and you do find that you develop skills and abilities that you didn't, you know, think that you had. And I think that's a good thing. But obviously I've also managed to find ways of working in health and doing what I feel most comfortable with as well.
So Lisa, we're obviously come to your decision to move from the SNP to the Tories. But before we do, I wonder if you could, I suppose, just talk listeners through, I suppose, from entering Parliament as an SNP politician, you know, through your re-elections. Did your relationship with the party start to change, or how you perceived the SNP?
Yeah, absolutely. When I entered Parliament, a lot of my work focused on cross-party work, disability and animal rights. I did Lucy's Law, and that was supported by Michael Gove, and managed to get that into legislation. I also have chaired the Disability All Party Group for 9 years now since I started, and that's been very much cross-party based. And I think standing up and saying one Parliament works and another one doesn't became something that I felt wasn't accurate, and actually both parliaments have evidence of best practice in some of the things they do and things that don't work in others, and it's more helpful to collaborate and share best practice right across the UK. Obviously the first election and then the second one was sort of based around about Brexit, because that was the big issue that was coming downstream. But my own relations with party had become strained over a period of time, linked with the ability to have conscience votes because I'm a Christian in Parliament, and also because I'm a psychologist, as I've mentioned, I had supported the victim of harassment in a case where it had been perpetrated by an SNP MP who acknowledged that in the Parliament and had to apologise. And I felt that the party had come down in support of the Member of Parliament who had been the abuser rather than the victim. And when I raised that, there was a level of hostility towards me in the party at that point. And I felt that, that just increased over time. And also my feelings during the COVID pandemic, because I was chairing the Health All Party Group and we were doing so much work across the UK, sharing expertise with scientists coming on to, you know, to speak to us each day from various different parts of the UK. And I began to think that, you know, we're much better collaborating and supporting each other as four nations. And then, of course, Ukraine happened, and given, well, I would call it the Scottish government, a calamity government at the current time, I felt that on defence, it's much better for Scotland to have an integrated defence system as part of the UK than to have the First Minister Hamza Yousaf in charge of defence. So all of these issues were coming together, and I had at one point thought that I would go back to health and work in health and leave Parliament, actually. But the Prime Minister had been very, very supportive, and particularly of my disability work, and had encouraged me to continue that and to remain in Parliament because he felt that was very valuable. And my family, you'd ask me about if my family were, they weren't particularly political, but my family are conservatives. So it seemed like a natural journey for me in that sense. I was moving from a constitutional divide. I think many families in Scotland had been divided, back to issue-based politics, left or right of centre. And, you know, I always was brought up in a family with conservative values. And, you know, my mum was able to buy her council home under Margaret Thatcher. And this had been a massive thing for her family at the time, because she'd worked so, so hard when I was a single parent for some of my upbringing as well. And it was about aspiration and hard work and education. And I felt that I was really just coming full circle back to my beginnings, in a sense, joining the Conservatives, and have felt very, very supported in that journey, principally by the Prime Minister.
And the SNP in the past have sometimes, you know, or parts of it have been called tartan Tories, which is, you know, the suggestion of, yes, you might support independence, but there are figures in the party who, to some of the things you were saying, a bit more to the right on certain issues. And it feels certainly under Nicola Sturgeon and Hamza Yousaf that's moved further away. Business would speak more fondly of Alex Salmond, for example, and his policies than some of the ones now. Do you recognise that? Do you think the party has, the SNP has moved to the left in recent years on I would say culture wars issues, perhaps that's the wrong thing, but, you know, some of these social issues as well as the economy?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've always been quite a business-minded person. I worked in the NHS, but I also ran my own psychology business as well. And I feel that Scotland's a place that's had entrepreneurs, as you know, throughout its history. And I feel that the SNP have moved very left, not supportive of business in the way it has been. Tax regime as well is sort of chasing innovators and professionals south of the border, and I don't think that's a helpful situation. And also, you spoke about the culture wars. I think, yeah, all of a sudden in most of the meetings I felt people were speaking more about gender identity politics than independence, and it just seemed that again this was something that I was going to be clashing with them on, and actually so many women in my constituents.
I suppose at the time, Lisa, you were facing, I think, a bit of a battle, or that was what alleged, with the SNP trying to move a different candidate in. And they called foul play because they claimed that, you know, you switched to the Tories just before they would have brought in the different SNP candidate. What do you say to that?
Well, I mean, I think it was quite clearly orchestrated from headquarters because it was someone who worked at headquarters. And the fact that I had won MP of the Year from the Patchwork Foundation, also been named MP of the Year by Sense, the disability charity, for my disability work. And I think it was very orchestrated, and it just consolidated my feeling that I you know, wasn't fitting into the SNP nationalism. I think at that point things were very negative. I really think the public probably now see it as a failed experiment. And I felt that throughout that period I felt so bad actually and depressed that I, for the first time as a psychologist, I had to have counselling at Westminster for the hostility I'd experienced, and I was also on antidepressants. And my GP had said to me, and it was the final straw, and he said, you know, I can keep giving you the medication, but it's your situation, you have to change. And I think that all just culminated, and I knew that I was doing good work in Parliament, that it was something that the Prime Minister valued, my disability work, and that with the other issue that we hadn't quite covered there was the gender politics, where I'd written to Alistair Jack because women in my constituency had raised issues with the gender reform bill. I felt that, you know, it was more of a fit for me to go back to my roots with the Conservative Party, and that the SNP actually being there wasn't good for my health and probably not good for the welfare of Scotland either.
I think Humza Yousaf said it was the least surprising news he'd had since becoming leader. And after that happened too, I read that you had to go into hiding for a few days because there was backlash, potential threats. How tough was that? And do you think that SNP politicians made the situation worse with their rhetoric?
Well, it didn't help because the president of the SNP at that point, Mike Russell, had described my decision as an odd tantrum, which I felt was a very misogynistic thing to say, and sort of gave carte blanche for people to be abusive towards me. And obviously, you know, cybernats online. I mean, the constitutional politics of Scotland has been so divided. It divided my family for a period of time. It's divided many families, and it's become a very toxic culture in that sense. And I felt, you know, I've got young children, that I had to take all of the security advice that was given by the Parliament and make sure that they were safe, close the constituency office for a period of time, make sure that my staff were safe, because those were my responsibilities as well. And I think it's very sad that politics in Scotland had descended to those depths. It didn't surprise me really, because I feel like, you know, there's a lot of negativity around about the party, the SNP at that point in time. Things were failing. As I say, I think people in Scotland were beginning to realise that nationalism itself was a failed experiment. And that means that people who do become desperate to have independence and nationalism at the fore become more extreme, perhaps, and that's, you know, the focus of it became me for a while.
And as you mentioned, the Prime Minister, obviously now in the Tory party, but you're planning to stand down at the next election. Looking at things now, do you think independence would now be the wrong choice for Scotland, or is it the wrong choice while the SNP is in the state it is in?
Well, I mean, it's an absolute calamity government. But I think, I feel when I review it, that after the referendum, people in Scotland said, okay, we'll give you an opportunity to see what you can do, to see if you can make a difference to the party. And they obviously had electoral success at that point. But now, I mean, there's failures in health. I spend an inordinate amount of time trying to get access to GPs and operations for local constituents. Education has, in Scotland, we're so proud of educational standards, and now those have, you know, come down to such levels that government doesn't even want to print where they are on the table. Transport, taxation, business, woke gender culture. I think everything just, you know, smacks of incompetence, really. And I think that my journey's probably seemed unique at the time, but it's not really. I think it's quite an ordinary journey that many people now in Scotland are moving, turning the page on nationalism and moving back to a politics that they should be based, and realise that nationalism has been pretty much a failed experiment.
And I suppose, looking at where we are now, we're speaking on the day there's lots of drama north of the border. I wondered, as you know, someone has spoken of their religion, if you think a figure like Kate Forbes would make more of a difference, or would the SNP just not accept someone who, maybe similar issues to the ones you faced, who almost has been criticised so heavily for their faith, even if they're not trying to change policies based off it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a feeling now that the Scottish government under the SNP has become utterly useless. And I think, to be honest, that Scotland does deserve better, more competent government. And, you know, I'd like to see an election happen in Scotland sooner rather than later to try to deliver a more consensual issues-based politics there again. And I think people are yearning for change there too. And it seems quite a long way away, 2026, for the next Scottish Parliament election. It feels like this Scottish government has been trundling along, not making much of a difference for such a long time. And of course, all of the other issues in the background, with the police investigation and those issues that are bearing on people's mind as well. So I'm not sure how much longer this government can limp on.
Just to go back to where you are now, and it sounds as though the situation has calmed in terms of the fact that you had to go into hiding. Things are calmer now in your constituency. But what would you say to those voters who would say, well, I didn't vote for a Conservative MP, I voted for an SNP one, therefore you should call a by-election? Would you say, well, we're so near an election anyway, or what's your line to them?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting one. More people in my constituency voted for unionist parties than voted for nationalist parties. And those voters might have said, well, we didn't vote for you, so we won't come to you. I've always had the position that I've helped everybody, no matter their background, no matter their political persuasion, who comes to me. As I say, we've helped over 26,000 people. And that's the situation we're in. I'm not the first person to move party. People have moved to the ALBA party. We've had a Conservative MP move to the Labour Party. The situation is that when you move party, you don't have to have a by-election. And actually, my understanding is that SNP MPs voted against that position in Holyrood as well, and voted that you wouldn't have to call a by-election if you move party. So I think it's quite hypocritical to say just because it's me, and actually I'm the only woman in that situation that I'm aware of at Westminster in the current parliament, that I should be the one to call a by-election.
We often hear anti-Tory rhetoric from the SNP, and it can be quite personal. But I wondered, you talked about the Prime Minister. I wondered, have any Tories been particularly welcoming since you crossed over? Obviously, it's quite a difficult period to say, you know, show you the ropes on the Conservative side.
Yeah, absolutely. There's been so many. It's been such a welcoming environment. I mean, I no longer have to attend counselling now. I'm not on any antidepressant medication. That's just been a short 6 months, but it feels, you know, so much more positive for me. So Graham Brady and his wife Victoria have been particularly supportive of me. And Gavin Williamson has been such a help and mentor in that sense. And, you know, there's just been many, many people. I've had good conversations with Andrea Ledson. And I find it difficult actually to think of anyone who hasn't been helpful, supportive and welcoming. Certainly Douglas Ross and the Scottish Conservatives have been amazing as well. And I was able to introduce him at the Scottish Conference, which was my first Scottish Conservative conference just a few months ago, and members were you know, overwhelmingly positive and welcoming and interested in my journey from yes to no and how we can support those other people in our community to make the same journey and to move from a position of nationalism to supporting the United Kingdom and realising that actually we're much better when we pool and share our resources and expertise in so many, many ways.
And a final question we ask everyone on this podcast, which is, what is the worst advice you've ever been given? It may have been from your old party, it may have been an earlier stage in your life, and you don't have to have taken the advice, of course.
Well, it's probably when I was told that being an MP, you know, it would be fine in terms of family life, because I would say MPs always have to struggle and juggle all of the various demands with family life. And when I first became an MP, I was told that would all be straightforward. It certainly hasn't been. My youngest was only 18 months when I arrived in Parliament, and I brought her in her buggy. And, you know, so many changes have happened, so many more have to happen so that people can become MPs from all walks of life, and those who have children as well can come and they can have a work-life balance, because I think we still don't have that in the correct place.
Thank you, Lisa. Thank you for joining the podcast today.
Thank you so much.